The name of the new book is The Arena, Inside the Tailgating, Ticket Scalping, Mascot Racing, Dubiously Funded, and Possibly Haunted Monuments of American Sport. The book is published by Liveright, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Rafi Kohan to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. It's great to be here.
What drew your attention to this subject of wanting to talk about arenas and where we, for the most part, hold our most important sporting events?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a huge sports fan. I always have been. And, you know, even when I was a kid, of course, I loved going to games. But it was never really just the games that appealed to me. I kind of always noticed or paid attention to some of these other stadium elements that made a day at the arena, the ballpark, so special and exciting. You know, whether it was the scalpers outside or the grounds crew guys raking the turf or, you know, the mascots racing through the stands. It just seemed like there was this complex ecosystem that existed at the stadium that I just never really knew that much about. And I wanted to learn more. I wanted to learn more about these underexplored worlds. And so it seemed like a great opportunity to jump in the car and hop on a few planes and travel for a year and spend time in and around these facilities to see what I could dig up.
I want to talk to you, of course, of what's going on in these facilities when they're at the height of their operation. I was reading your book, however, when I was away, and I was staying in Anaheim, California, and right next to Angel Stadium, and they were out of town while we were there. And I'm reading your book, and I'm looking at the stadium, and I thought to myself, is there anything really more sort of deflating than to just see an empty stadium without being that beehive of activity?
Oh my God, absolutely. It's kind of amazing the way that these places come to life, right?
Yes.
You know, they become almost small cities on the day of the game. For a few hours, they become the centerpiece, you know, the center of activity. But then 100%, it's almost like, you know, when the lights shut off and everyone goes away,
right,
they're like a complete drain on, you know, on the city in some ways, which actually can happen both in terms of, you know, economically, when you put a big stadium somewhere and it's not turned on, it almost operates to like suck out the economic energy because there's nothing happening. So no one's going there. And in the same way that when they actually like meet their ultimate fate, whether it's, you know, places like the Silverdome or the Astrodome or, you know, or wherever, that whether they get demolished or they remain in existence, it's such a bizarre thing to see these stadiums, which meant so much to so many people, which house so many memories and so many spectacular events and achievements, then just abandoned, you know, left alone,
right,
to sort of meet their fate as, you know, weeds grow through the concrete and nature takes its course. It's truly bizarre. It is.
The other thing, too, that struck me is just how often or how rare it is to actually have a game. I mean, this is true, obviously, more with football than it is with baseball. But still, when you look at the calendar year, these places really aren't open that much.
No, that's exactly right. You know, for football, it's 10 games a year, including preseason, you know, assuming you don't make the playoffs. And then for baseball, which is the most, you know, hosts the most events, is 81. Although, I mean, arenas, of course, are, you know, can become the busiest because, you know, indoor facilities, maybe they house both hockey and basketball, maybe a WNBA team, maybe some college, and then they can do circuses and concerts and Disney on Ice and all these other things. And, you know, and the busy ones can, you know, like Madison Square Garden and Staples Center can pretty much, you know, be in use 365 days a year or close to it. But otherwise, absolutely, there are tons of dark days. And for football, you know, that's one of the arguments that folks like Roger Knoll, who's a preeminent stadium economist, would say. He would say that why would you would never spend this much money on a facility like on a mall if it was only going to be open 10 days a year? It's just bananas. We sort of change our calculus when it comes to sports.
One of the chapters I found so interesting in the book is about security and, of course, a very important element to our wife these days, but what these crews do to keep the peace and controlling the crowds at the arenas, and especially, and as you point out, this is more the case in some places than it is in others.
Yeah, well, I was very lucky to have the opportunity to go behind the scenes. Yeah, in the chapter where I talk about fan behavior and security, the San Diego Padres welcomed me behind the scenes, which was a very, very unlikely thing to happen. As you might expect, a lot of the teams are very close to the vest when it comes to their security practices. Maybe they're just a little bit more laid back in Southern California, I don't know. But I got to go and sit in the command center and see all the cameras at work. You know, it was literally like a Big Brother type situation where you could see almost every inch both inside and outside of the stadium. And it's all about, you know, it's about controlling movement. You know, they want to know that, you know, keeping a finger on the pulse in terms of like the attitude of the crowd, if there's going to be issues in the parking lot where most of the issues happen. So that, you know, that's more for football when there's a tailgate culture, but it's, you know, having security guards around, having a presence, and being aware of what's happening. And so, you know, that was what was so cool and kind of creepy, if I'm being honest, about all these cameras. You know, one guy hit a home run from the opposing team and it went into the stands, and you know, one of the hometown fans took the ball and threw it back on the field, and we immediately zoomed in, you know, from the command center, and we could see this guy exactly. We knew exactly who it was. We could basically see the size of the soda he was drinking. You know, the power of this zoom was so incredible. At another point during the game, a couple of like surfer bums set up shop outside of the stadium, not even inside. They laid down a blanket and took out, you know, a bottle of liquor and started drinking. And one of the security guards asked the head of security, "Hey, John, do you want these guys setting up camp here?" And John, you know, says, "No, not really." And suddenly, you know, a police officer, was called, sent outside, and walks up to them. The guy sees him come and hide the bottle. And then someone from the command center whispers in his ear, you know, the bottle is under the blanket. And he's demanding the bottle. And suddenly these two guys are looking at each other like some sort of dark magic spell was cast. Like, how did they know? So it's really unbelievable the incredible lengths they go to, you know, to try and keep that, you know, the finger on the pulse.
The other thing you talk about, and it's really interesting, I think it's interesting too, is how important tradition is at so many of these places. And even if you have a new stadium or a new arena, that they try to either hold over some degree of the tradition or bring a part of the city's tradition into that facility.
Absolutely. I think tradition is everything, especially when it comes to sports. I mean, we have these are the places we go to where we have emotional memory, where we have, you know, sort of, you know, sporting memory, whether it was achievements on the field or, you know, the family or friends that we went to these games with. And I think that kind of, you know, that feeling kind of wraps itself in the physical structures. And so it's really hard to duplicate that when we have new buildings. So teams are smart, at least, to try and recreate that in any way they can, because that's what ties us to the generations past. You know, buildings like Fenway Park in Boston or Wrigley Field in Chicago, you know, they have the benefit of being in the same physical space where they've been for 100+ years. So it's very easy to feel that connection to the generations gone by or the players gone by. You know, that the last time you went to a game 15 years ago when someone hit a walk-off homer, you know, you can remember that vividly when you walk in the next time. But when you walk into a new facility, that's not there. So it is about the tradition. Is it, you know, what can you do to tie us to the past? And in some cases, fans take it upon themselves, you know, because maybe it's not even tradition that exists within the stadium. Maybe it's things like having a certain tailgate and inviting, you know, your next door neighbor, you know, with you to the game, and you're going to serve this particular dish. Or maybe you know, as they did outside of Lambeau Field, where I tailgated with Packers fans, they say the Wedge of Allegiance, you know, to the Packers and orate a poem about Tim, the diehard Packer fan.
Right.
Or at Penn State games, they do something called communion, which mostly involves taking a shot of Jägermeister and then singing the the school fight song. So there's ways that bring the tradition as well. It's not all just about the building or just about the team, but it's what that space allows us to do.
One of the things I learned, many things I learned in the book, but one of the things that I learned that I was fascinated by, because I had no idea this existed, which bothered me because I wish I knew this had existed, but I do now, and that is that there is such a thing as the Mascot Hall of Fame.
and soon it's going to have a physical space. For a long time, the Mascot Hall of Fame was almost just like a state of mind.
Yes.
It existed. They would meet in Philadelphia, and they would give out an award. And I believe because they couldn't actually, mascots don't talk, so they would give speeches, but they wouldn't say anything to their acceptance speeches. It was mostly just, I think, spray silly string on each other. But I believe next year, 2018, there's going to be a physical Mascot Hall of Fame opening somewhere in Indiana, and man, I would love to visit that place.
Well, it's great, and it has some representation within the Baseball Hall of Fame, at least for baseball mascots, the Philly Fanatic being there, and in my, as a Philadelphian, but also as a Muppet fan, I believe to be our greatest mascot. But Dave Raymond, who long performed as the Philly Fanatic, is the guy behind this.
Yeah, the original.
Yeah, really interesting stuff.
Yeah, and I won't disagree with you that the Philly Fanatic is the number one, especially when it comes to team mascots. The only wrinkle I'll throw into that is that I think he has a little bit of competition if we expand it and include the San Diego Chicken, who, of course, never actually been associated with any team, not the Padres, not the Chargers. He's always been more of a freelance mascot, would come in, work games, but he traveled around the world for decades. And he actually predates the Philly Fanatic by a few years at least, maybe five or six or something like that. But Ted Giannoulis, who is the man behind the beak, he also has done a lot for mascotting. And I think he and Dave Raymond are on the same level.
Right, and as you know, the one and only Chicken, but also his act was a bit more bawdy, right? He would do things that the Fanatic would not do.
Yeah, and maybe it was a function of the fact that he was this sort of visiting presence.
Yeah.
That he knew he needed to put on a show, and he had to have more gags and really make an impression. Whether it was pooping out a chicken egg or
That's the way you say that. Yeah, that's
That's
the way. That's it.
Okay. We found it.
Yeah, you found it.
Or kicking dirt on an umpire, or, he even found a way to interact with the players. There was one time he told me some story about how a player, I believe on the Padres, had a series of errors, and it was an all-star player. I forget which player it was. But, he wanted to make light of the situation. So after, the third error in three games or something, he went out there between innings, and he demanded the glove from the player and held it up to the light and was checking it for holes, to see if anything was wrong with the glove. And the player came up to him afterwards and said, Ted, if that was anyone else, I would have punched him right in the face. But he just laughed, and it kind of lightened the mood for the whole stadium. Everyone kind of, not that they need to forgive him for making errors, but it just felt like they were all in it. They got it. It was a thing that happened.
All right. So let me turn serious for a second. And I have a wild and woolly question to ask you. So this will probably be a little bit shaggy in its origin, but here we go. So you want to go see a game, and you may go to some of the sites online, StubHub or so forth, and you see, and you say, oh my God, the tickets are $250, $300 to go see the game. And, I wonder if there's any tickets left. You go on the team's website, and you realize that, face value can be $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $1,000. And you say, oh, my God, I can actually save money maybe on the scalping site. But then, okay, so the $50 to park, the hundreds of dollars, whatever you get for, depending on the team, but to get the ticket, walking through the door, and $15 for a beer and $10 for a hot dog. Is this sustainable?
That's the million or billion or tens of billion dollar question right there, which is one that I think teams across leagues are trying to figure out, which is, how do you get people to keep coming to games? I think people will keep coming to games on some level just because this is one of the last places where we come together as a community, where there's, you know, public gatherings for a live event, whereas otherwise we're hanging out with our iPhones or watching Netflix or whatever. But, you know, I think there are a lot of drawbacks, you know, in terms of there's traffic, there's the cost of the game. When you're talking about football in particular, it's really a sport that's designed for TV. As my friend Will Leach put it a couple days ago, it's almost like all of us in the stands are like extras, you know, for the TV audience. So I think teams are trying to figure out what is that added value, what can get people to keep coming. And for baseball, you know, I really think it's a lot about these kind of segmented and individualized experiences. You go to a game and now there's a kid zone and there's the luxury club for the people who want that. But there's also maybe the standing room and then a tequila bar. So we can each have our own sort of personalized experiences when we go to the game. In some ways, it kind of splinters us and maybe we're not communing in the same, you know, sort of single-minded way that we once were when we attended games, but they're just trying to get us through the gate. And for football, I think it's much tougher for all the reasons that we were just talking about, traffic, cost, and the convenience of being at home, the fact you can watch it on TV and you have food in the fridge and a bathroom nearby. But teams are trying to draw us with, you know, over-the-top luxury amenities in some cases. They're trying to draw us. In Atlanta, actually, right now, it hasn't opened yet, but the new Mercedes-Benz Stadium, they're doing an experiment with street-level pricing for their food. Hot dogs are going to be $2, and 12-ounce beers will be $5. And it's an opportunity to try to provide value. Say, yeah, you paid a lot of money for your ticket, but we're not gonna gouge you on the concession side. So I think teams are playing around and figuring out what is it that, you know, that will get fans coming back. I certainly, you know, will be happier to pay, you know, $5 for a beer instead of $15. Will that be enough to then make me pay $200 for the ticket in the first place? I'm not sure, but that's what they're trying to figure out.
Well, the book is really very fun and enjoyable to read. It is The Arena, Inside the Tailgating, Ticket Scalping, Mascot Racing, Dubiously Funded, and Possibly Haunted Monuments of American Sport. Ravi Kohan, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, the pleasure was all mine. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you very much. Again, the book is The Arena by Ravi Kohan. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.